This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 59, and we're recording on Friday, June 27th. I'm Jeff O'Neill, I'm here with Rebecca Shinsky. We're the editors of BookRiot.com. It feels like we're in the middle of summer now.
It's
like
really
the middle of summer. I kind of got that malaise/relax thing going on.
I do too. I'm newly marathoning The West Wing on Netflix.
I couldn't be more excited about this.
I'm reading some good books. It's really hot here, and all I want to do is not work. Does that sound like middle of summer to you?
That sounds about right to me. And it's a relatively slow week in the book world, but there, as always, a few interesting tidbits. We'll start with our follow-up. Unsurprisingly, everyone thinks that Leawood, Kansas, grabbed the wrong end of this lollipop in coming down on this kid. Well, is it the kid or the dad?
It's a kid. Yeah, 9-year-old Spencer Collins put up if you didn't hear last week's show, he put up a little free library in his front yard, and the city of Leawood, Kansas, which is a suburb of Kansas City, ordered him to remove it and threatened him with fines.
And so now Lemony Snicket has come down because apparently he is also a thinking person to say this is terrible. And this has really spread around since last week. I'm seeing a bunch of people linked to it. I'm sure the city planner of Leawood, Kansas, had no idea what he was getting into.
The commentary has been really fun and funny to read for the most part. You know, some of the variations on don't city officials have better things to worry about. I've seen lots of great Leslie Knope references, which always makes me happy. But Lemony Snicket, whose real name is Daniel Handler, is sending 9-year-old Spencer Collins a bunch of his own books and lending his support to this call for Leawood to allow them to keep the tiny library, which the last thing that I read, I believe yesterday morning, was that Spencer and his family are going like before a city council type meeting to plead their case and get to keep the thing. But there's a Facebook page now in support of the Little Free Library that has like 27,000 likes.
Yeah, that is not a joke. Since it's been like 2 weeks, essentially. Michelle, she is an architect, and so I told her about it, and immediately, of course, her fuse was lit. and she was like, so does no one in Leawood have a doghouse? And I was like, oh.
Well, probably not in their front yard.
Yeah, anyway, and so I thought that was interesting about that. My guess is Leawood is going to turn around on this one. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah, the city, the mayor of Leawood, her name is Peggy Dunn. She said that the city might be able to make an exception for Spencer's library on July 7th, which raises the question of why not just decide that this is a net good for the community, and if anyone else in the suburb of Leawood, which is a relatively large place, wants to have a little free library, that they can do it as well. The piece that we're going to link to in the show notes also notes that 15,000 little free libraries have sprung up all over the U.S. And there's a map that can help you locate one. So that's pretty cool. But the meeting that Spencer and his family will be attending is on July 7th. So it's going to be another couple of weeks before this is resolved. It seems to me that this is a ridiculous amount of time for this to take. Like when we talked about it last week,
city government, I'm surprised it's a month, less than a month.
I thought like surely next week we'll be saying, oh, by the way, Leawood, Kansas saw the error of their ways.
I mean, I'm sure Councilman Jam was trying to delay the proceedings and trying to squeeze.
You
got jammed. I think Spencer Collins got jammed by someone with a notepad and
an
ordinance book.
Clearly the work of a former Eagletonian.
Spencer, we're going to keep you up to date. 15,000 little free libraries.
Doesn't that make you feel a little better about the world?
Yeah, there's a map. I should spend some time with that map doing some data analysis.
yes, all right. Clearly.
because that will be a super good use of, that's a good use of my time, probably. So let's do our first sponsor. Squarespace is back. So it's summertime. Maybe you're out of school. Maybe you've got some, you know, summer Fridays, whatever job you have. Maybe you're thinking about working on that web project that you've been noodling with for a while. You should give Squarespace a try. It's an all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Here's the deal. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code POETRY at the checkout. You get a two-week free trial, and it's not one of those free trials where you have to enter your credit card information and then you accidentally, oops, on purpose, get charged when you forget about it. No credit card required, just an email address. They'll set you up with your own domain name that you can show to other people and figure out how to use it. So here's why you should do it. Constantly improving their platform. Like, they had a Super Bowl ad. Like, this is not a joke. They have beautiful designs for you to start with. This is the important part. You start with a nice looking template. All of their templates are use responsive design, which means they're made to adapt to the size of the device that whoever is looking at your website is using. So if they're using a phone, a tablet, a laptop, a 30-inch monitor, all these templates are designed from the ground up to be beautiful on all of those templates. There's 20 of them, and they're all very highly customizable. They've won a bunch of awards from places you or I haven't heard of, but they're, you know, Forbes, Webby's, things like that to use. Here's another thing that's different. So you do have to pay for it. There are other blogging online platforms out there that are free, but you get what you pay for when it's free. One thing that you get with your, you know, small $8, $10, depending on how long you sign up for, monthly fee for Squarespace is 24-hour a day, 7-day a week support. They have over 70 employees on their customer care team right here in the Big Apple of New York City, waiting, eager, anxious to talk to you. It starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Unique mobile experience. They have a nice thing, too. They have a little, I was playing with this a few weeks ago, it's called Squarespace Logo, where you can enter in the name of whatever it is you're working on, and it's a very simple text manipulation program to make a logo. So it's not just Helvetica or whatever. You can make it in colors, you can bend it around, illustrate, things of that nature. So it gives you a nice header if you want to put on a business card. You can export it as a PDF or a JPEG and use it in other print documents. So that's Squarespace Logo. Start with no credit card, build your own website, and you could have a website up in 15 minutes. That's one of the great things to do. If I were starting my own personal website, and I started one for a while, which I kept up for about 2 months until I realized that, hey, you have no time to do anything ever, I use Squarespace, and that's what I would do again in the future. So thanks so much for Squarespace for sponsoring the show. Here's what I would say. If you're going to spend enough time that you're going to be serious about something online at all, you should spend $8 a month for the best tool you can get. And I think Squarespace is probably the best tool out there for you.
For sure. I can confirm that the summer is a good time to start a blog because I started my first blog on July 1st of 2008.
Mine was April 10th, 2010.
And I would have paid way more than $8 a month to have people just to have people on call to tell me what the heck yeah. I was supposed to be doing.
I mean,
doing
all the things you want to do with the blog, you know, Twitter integration, publish to all your social media feeds from right there. You can build in ads. They have built-in e-commerce that supports checkout and all those kinds of things that are built into the platform. It looks great. It's the best looking blogging platform out there. So, anyway, thanks to Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com. Use offer code POETRY. Get yourself a trial. See what you like. Okay. So we have kind of like a lot of follow-up of ongoing. Like we just have some meta stories, right?
Kind of a follow miscellaneous, you know, show this week. Simon & Schuster, I think we talked about it when they launched this ebook pilot program last year. They signed up 20 different library systems across the United States to test out lending ebooks. And the pilot program went successfully, which is a great thing to hear. For a while there was some tension between various publishers and libraries about how they were going to manage ebook lending with their patrons. And so now any library across the United States can access Simon & Schuster's whole catalog of ebooks, everything that they've published. They buy a copy of the ebook that's good for a one, like the terms state that it's good for 1 year. It can only be lent to one patron at a time, just like a physical book. But here is the really great thing, and the thing that makes this different from other publisher library agreements, is that they can lend the ebook an unlimited number of times within that 1 year period. It seems that publishers are starting to figure out that just like lending print books through libraries, lending ebooks is a thing that is ultimately good for them and their bottom line. And so there's no, you can have this ebook and only lend it 16 times, which I think was a HarperCollins.
They were also different. Rule. It's impossible to remember. The various minutiae of each publisher's deal.
Right. But so this is good. This is movement towards making ebooks just as accessible for library patrons as print books are. And because they don't take up physical space, ebooks can be more accessible. So there will be no limits beyond what a library is willing to purchase and to lend. So I'm happy, super happy to see this, that Simon & Schuster is, you know, joining digital progress and opening up this service so that libraries can provide readers with all the books they want.
I feel like
it's good.
We've got another year, 18 months of pain on like making ebooks available to libraries, and then pain as far as the eye can see for actually checking out ebooks from your library. There's a couple of things, but this is the move in the right direction.
Yeah, this is absolutely the right direction. I can't imagine publishers saying to libraries, like, here's the full catalog of our print books, and you're only allowed to purchase from this section of the catalog right. for your library. So to see that they're starting to equate ebooks with print books, and it's just a difference in how the book is delivered, seems to be... Mm-hmm. Good movement. I'm happy for this. There's not really much else to say except like good job, Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, good. That's a good thing to see. So that's one. Figuring out ebooks and all the distribution channels, that's one big narrative, right? And libraries is a major chain mm-hmm. that has its own pricing and distribution issues sort of getting worked out. The other meta level narrative we've been following and probably will be following for as long as you and I exist on this planet is the consolidation and the changing of how the publishing industry itself is put together. And as we've talked about for what feels like 10,000 years now, Hachette.
Forever.
Hachette is in an ongoing dispute with Amazon, but not content only to be in a dispute with Amazon. They're moving other pieces of the chessboard, and they have agreed to purchase Perseus Books, which is a big middle size publisher, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not one of the big five, but it's one of the big however many that are right below that.
Right. They have 650 employees in 8 offices. That includes PGW, DeCapo, Westview Presses, Consortium, Running Press. A lot of those people work at their huge warehouse in Tennessee. But what they're going to do is they're buying the backlist and the front list too of Perseus. Mm-hmm. And then they also have Perseus has a distribution, part of their company that does distribution for a bunch of smaller presses. And those are being sold to Ingram, which is one of the big book distributors. So it's kind of they're taking the pig and splitting it in half and giving the parts to the people that make the most sense. You know, this is Hachette at scale. It's like HarperCollins buying Harlequin, right?
Yep.
I mean, I don't know if it's any more complicated than that.
No, I think it comes at an interesting time because this week there was no real news in the development of this Amazon Hachette dispute. There were no more rockets fired from either side of that. But to be reminded of how huge Hachette mm-hmm. is, the piece that we're reading from was in Publishers Marketplace this week. And they note that they were told definitively that Perseus's publishing revenues are between $90 and $100 million. Annually, following a series of record years that they've had. So there's not been a public announcement of how much Hachette paid to acquire Perseus, but it's not a small amount of money if you're talking about $90 or $100 million just from their publishing revenue.
And then their distribution was as another 100 million or so, and that's going to Ingram.
And Hachette has been talking about, you know, aggressively growing their backlist. This is a lot of serious nonfiction. Hachette Livre, the big company is Hachette Livre, and they're based in France. So they are focusing on growing in the U.S. And this consolidation is part of it.
Yep.
But interesting to see this juxtaposed against some of the stuff we've seen in the previous weeks about defending Hachette and protecting Hachette from big bad Amazon. If you are making deals to buy companies that are doing $100 million annually in revenue, you're not little.
Hachette does $740 million in revenue off their own publishing.
Right.
So it adds about 15%. And that puts their bottom line revenue.
That puts you pretty close to $1 billion.
Pretty close.
In annual revenue. It's going to be interesting, and it might be frustrating to watch what happens between Hachette and Amazon, and then to think about potential fallout from that will affect other parties in publishing, authors and booksellers and libraries. But Hachette itself does not seem to be in a position where it needs protection or quote unquote support from readers to stay alive. They seem to be doing just fine.
Perseus was privately held, so someone did okay with this. They add about 6,000 titles into some areas they haven't been before. You know, if I'm Hachette and I can do this, I do this, right? I make it more painful for Amazon not to carry me, in a sense. It also means their gross revenues will now exceed Simon & Schuster's. So I think that would put them at about third place behind Random Penguin and then Harper. And now I think Hachette will be third,
and then Simon,
and then Macmillan, and then HMH. I think that's kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
But they leapfrog someone. Like, and it doesn't really matter. You know, there's no like big lead. There's no big board where if once you leapfrog someone else, you get new special privileges and powers. But it does sort of make you have a little bit more scale, a little bit more efficiency, a little bit more ammo to fire at Amazon or anyone else for that matter, honestly, that might get in your way.
The leapfrogging imagery, I'm just sitting here picturing like a video game based on publishers, and they jump into the Mario frog suit and get to like bloop, bloop, bloop.
Yeah.
Seriously. I don't know, it's Friday afternoon, but could we make this more fun?
I think so. I mean, you don't think that talking about insider business deals on ebooks and libraries is fun?
With you, it is, Jeff.
Ah, there you go.
With the internet in general, it could use some Mario.
We've got another industry story. This was really the big story of the week, that Barnes & Noble, in its fiscal year-end annual report, if any of you are still awake, I salute you. You know, a couple interesting things, but the big news is that they're going to separate the Barnes & Noble retail part of the company from the Nook part of the company, which has been long rumored.
Yeah.
Nook has been a millstone around the financial reporting weight of Barnes & Noble for some time, and they're going to separate them off and I guess let Nook sink or swim on its own, but try to unlock some of the good things that are really happening at Barnes & Noble. This piece in Market Watch is what I'm reading. It said that this combined earnings, the EBITDA.
Now I'm definitely asleep.
Yeah, definitely asleep, whatever. But the way they figure their earnings is $251 million, the highest in 4 years. That's the part I really want to get at. The number they use to chart their growth and their health is higher than it's been in 4 years. And Nook, though, has been losing them at like $275 million a year and growing. And the revenues from the ebook business is really falling. And I think now that we can sort of get out of that minutia just for a second, I thought it might be worth talking about. Like, I think this says a couple of things. One is, I don't know if it's surprising, but the very real, at least middle-term endurance of print book sales. You know, Barnes & Noble is still selling a lot of print books. They've been cutting costs a lot, so their overall revenue is down, but they're making more money off what they do sell. And we've seen this with, you know, a rebound in the number of independent bookstores. So that's one part of it. I think the other part of it, too, is, boy, it's hard to compete with Amazon and ebooks. Man, it's tough.
Yep.
It sounds like, from what we've heard and what this MarketWatch thing says, that they entered into a new agreement with Samsung. It'll be like a co-branding thing. But Barnes & Noble and Nook, well, Barnes & Noble is getting out of the Nook business, but Nook itself is getting out of the device business. So they're going to focus on apps that you read on your iPad, use on your iPad mm-hmm. or your Google tablet or anything else like that. So that's what I'm seeing here. Anything? What do you think about this? Is it another simple one that looks complicated? I don't know. Maybe it's not.
You know, I mean, I think there's interesting pieces. A thing that we've been talking about offline with it also is that this doesn't fit the narrative that floats around the internet that you and I are constantly shaking our fists at of mm-hmm. publishing is dying, books are in trouble, like all books are in trouble, and so authors are going to be screwed and readers are going to be screwed, and the end is near.
Yeah.
The end is not nigh. Like, you put your sandwich board back in the closet for a while, because highest revenue in 4 years, doing better than you've been doing in 4 years, starting to solve some problems, figuring out what to do to make Nook cost them less. Mm-hmm. And maybe this sets up Nook to be acquired by Samsung.
Or Microsoft could wholly buy it if they didn't want to be in the Barnes & Noble business themselves.
Right. There are some interesting pieces here, but the big message is Barnes & Noble is doing better mm-hmm. than it has done in 4 years.
Yeah, its old business is doing better, way better than its new business.
Right, and for the largest bookstore chain in the country to be holding that out. And I wonder if maybe Barnes & Noble is getting some bump because of declines in indie bookstore sales.
Borders being gone. I mean, that probably corresponds to 4 years ago.
Like, the most recent numbers that we looked at about market share went from indie bookstores having about 6% of the book selling market to about 3%. Mm-hmm. And maybe those 3% of people are going into Barnes & Noble stores or ordering from Barnes & Noble online rather than converting to Amazon, or a section of them are. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the sky's not yet falling is what I'm walking away from this.
Yeah,
with.
I mean, I tweeted about this when this came out. I mean, we talked about last week on the show the health of the profit margin. The profit margins too, but the overall revenues of the big five publishers over the last 4 years is up 37%. Mm-hmm. And Barnes & Noble is having 4 year highs on earnings. And there are more bookstores opening over the last couple years than are closing. So it's not shrinking anymore.
Right.
It's not growing huge, but we're hearing more stories about people trying to open up stores and less about how everything's dying. So I actually got an email from one of you listeners last week saying, you know, I'm surprised that you guys have Audible sponsorships, because I know, Jeff, you hate Amazon and you're so strongly against Amazon, which I was a little surprised to hear, though I think in hindsight I kind of understand. I'm not really anti-Amazon. I am very, very watchful of Amazon. But the thing I really care about is trying to think as clearly about this stuff as I can. And so that's why, you know, if there's there is a counter narrative to Amazon's killing everyone, is that, well, Amazon certainly put a dent in their overall revenues, but publishing and Barnes & Noble and any bookstores, the ones that are still around, are adapting. Like, that's one thing that people forget about competition, is it's not just a one-way street where, you know, Amazon comes in and just like beats the crap out of you and you just sit there and take it. No, well, you try to learn how to use your left hand and how to dodge a little bit and things that go on of that nature. And I think if you know, I'm also cherry picking my data a little bit, that if you do over 12 years, the trend lines look differently. But if you look at the last 4 years, as people have had time to try to react to Amazon, do things differently with digital books and so on and so forth, they're figuring it out. Because as much as people like to pound on publishing and Barnes & Noble and how dumb everyone is and how smart Bezos is, there's a lot of smart people at a lot of these companies.
Yeah, and I think the Hachette acquisition points to this as well, of Hachette acquiring Perseus. That, and I think someone in my Twitter stream said it more eloquently than I'm about to, and I wish I could remember who that person was so I could give them mm-hmm. credit, but that Jeff Bezos is not the only one who's playing a long game here. The Random House Penguin merger last year should have reminded us of that, and this Hachette acquisition of Perseus, you know, you can look at continued consolidation as a sign that the end times are coming, but you can also look at it as a sign that now people at the top of these big, big businesses.
They're regrouping, are, you know, they're right. marshaling
they're,
their forces.
They're starting to do some active problem solving instead of the hand wringing. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that there's probably a year or 2 years left of pain for like libraries adapting to the ebook thing and publishers working that out, I don't think that we're looking near a finish line for pain being over between Amazon and everyone else in publishing. But it's really fantastic to see that these problems are being solved by indie booksellers, by publishers who are looking at new ways of doing things, by other services that are popping up to sort of fill some of the mm-hmm. gaps that are that have been left. There's a lot of really interesting and exciting stuff happening in books. And it would be so great if we could talk about that more.
At least in some kind of moderation, because I'm also not saying that we all can come out from our bomb shelters right. and the war is over. I'm not right. trying to say that either. I'm saying I don't know. And I also, something else on Twitter, it's like saying I'm not sure what's going to happen, let's pay attention, is not as good of a narrative, and it doesn't make for as good as internet as Amazon's killing us and they're evil. Let's do something about it, or Amazon's the best thing that ever happened to books. Screw all you guys who don't like them. I'm not sure I'm in the middle ground. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of on the side ground, kind of trying to figure out what would make the most sense.
Right. And I think it's the thing that I would want to point out to that listener, to our listeners in general, is we try not to be pro or con Amazon or anybody else in the bigger business sense, because you and I, and I think Book Riot in general, are less concerned about what happens to like big books or what happens to publishing than we are about what's good for mm-hmm. readers. And that's an important distinction in thinking about this. What happens to, like, I personally am invested in what happens to indie bookstores because I value them, and I believe that what happens to indie bookstores big picture affects what's good for readers, what's good for books. But it's possible that you like Amazon, and that's fine. If Amazon serves you as a reader and is doing what you want, and like your best possible world that you can imagine is a world where Amazon just runs everything because of the way that they serve their customers, that's an acceptable way to think about it too. And we get into this like locked false binary conversation right. So many times about either you're for Amazon or you're against them. And if you're not actively campaigning against Amazon, you're part of the problem. And that makes for better internet and better clickbait than a nuanced conversation does. But there are a lot of pieces on the board, and to simplify it that way, or to think that readers have to make one decision or the other in order to be doing the right thing for books. You know, I think if you're a reader, you do the right thing for your reading life and the things that, to the extent that you care about the future of publishing,
yeah,
you think make an effect. But like, I think sometimes it would be really great to just be a reader who reads books and is not at all concerned about the future of publishing.
Well, most of them are. Right. I mean, most readers are. I mean, we're interested in it for personal, financial, professional reasons. Also, I think the whole thing is fascinating. I mean, yeah. On a meta level, I think it's a very interesting, I don't know if chess game is the right metaphor, but
I think it kind of is. I'm thinking about The Merchants of Culture, which I know we've both read, which is a great book about the history of the publishing industry, if this is stuff that's ringing a bunch of your bells. And this is history repeating itself, mm-hmm. companies acquiring each other, publishers consolidating. Before there were the big six, there were like the big 12 that mm-hmm. bought each other and partnered up. And so this is not the first time that something along these lines has happened in response to new technology and publishing. The invention of the paperback did this to publishing before ebooks and e-tail did.
Yep. Well, you can look at other industries. Like, it would be hard to imagine in 1919 that some American car company was going to beat Ford.
Right.
Or that Ford wouldn't be the leader of the automobile industry for the foreseeable future. It's still around, but it's just one of many interesting players. I kind of do feel like what might be happening is some of these companies that are in publishing that Amazon's had a really adverse effect on, at least on a top level, I think maybe they are kind of regrouping and marshaling our forces, mm-hmm. Harper buying Harlequin, Penguin, Random House merging. We might see another of the big five go together, Hachette buying Perseus. Like, I wouldn't be surprised over the next 2 years we see more pushback on Amazon on a variety of fronts.
Even, I don't remember if you said it on a show or in a conversation we had offline, but like the thing that keeps, that we keep creeping up to is how interesting it would be if somebody as big as Penguin Random House just said no to Amazon. They publish more than 50% of the trade books that come out in a year. And so if they told Amazon, you know, of the books that come out from big publishers, you're not a retailer anymore. Right. You're losing access to 50% of all the books you would have been able to sell. We're going to roll our own, or we're going to focus on selling through Barnes and Noble and indie booksellers or whatever. The more the power in publishing is consolidated, I think the more likely it is that somebody is going to take that swing.
Yeah. And I, you know, you think about unintended consequences too. Let's say, for example, that Penguin Random House consolidates, they get more powerful, the big five become the big three or two. And let's say they beat Amazon, right? Let's say they beat Amazon. Is that good that we now have the big two and Amazon's gone? Like, I'm not sure we'd love that world. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of weird things to start thinking about in that regard. So, you know, it's difficult to say, you know, which of these outcomes is really the best. Amazon existing for a lot of people in publishing might be the worst case scenario, but it ain't the worst case scenario in general. Like, you know, kind of we've talked about this before on the show and offline as well. Is like our prime directive is something along the lines of a diverse number of good quality titles. That's really all we want from the industry, for ourselves and for other readers. And as long as that happens, I think everything else can kind of sort itself out. It's hard for me to see a world or some alignment of these businesses where suddenly there's a lot fewer books that we want to read. Like, I just don't see that. Do you see that happening? Like, it's hard for me to imagine what would need to take place for that to be the case.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. I think it's possible that fewer books will be published, or that fewer books will get the big marketing dollars. And that's a thing that already occurs, as publishers, you know, at least say that they have less money to spend on marketing. But there are still more new books that I'm interested in any given year than I can keep up with, not to mention all the backlist in the world. So it's hard for me to imagine publishing shrinking to a point that there aren't enough interesting new books to keep readers going, to keep us supplied with diverse content.
And I'm not saying that can't happen. But I'm just saying I have a very hard time myself coming up with a scenario.
It's just hard to picture that taking place. As we wrap up the conversation about Amazon, it might be worth noting, if you're in New York and you're interested in this, on Tuesday, July 1st, the New York Public Library is hosting, they're calling it a debate, but it sounds to me like it's really just going to be a conversation with a bunch of publishing professionals. James Patterson, Morgan Intrakin, who is the publisher and president of Grove Atlantic. There will be an attorney there, a theorist, a political person, and the person who's the elected chair of the Pulitzer Prize Board, Daniel Allen, will be in conversation with a literary agent named Tina Bennett, having a discussion called Amazon, Business as Usual, and it will focus on the Hachette-Amazon dispute, what's at stake for the companies, for authors, and for readers, and they're going to look at the larger issue, it says here, of free market capitalism and free speech that's at play. So if you want to nerd out about the industry or hear what a bunch of experts from various positions within publishing have to say, again, that's July 1st at the New York Public Library. We'll drop a link to the debate. I don't know what they're going to debate.
This sounds to me like, let's get together to be afraid of Amazon. Just from like the people on the panel. Like,
you know, I guess the conversation element of this is interesting. These are pretty reputable folks in publishing, and I'm curious about what they have to say. But also, I guess my inner skeptic that lives not too far below the surface is a little like, well, what is this actually going to accomplish? Are they going to like send Jeff Bezos the bullet points from the conversation? They're like, well, we have determined that you are not good for free market capitalism, and the consequences of this are unclear to me.
You know, I hadn't really thought about this before just this moment, even though it's something I've felt for a while. And tell me if your sense of it is the same as mine, but it feels to me like the sort of intellectual class the leftist intellectual class online, if there is such a thing, is kind of, there's kind of a homogeny of opinion, right? That mm-hmm. Amazon is bad.
Right.
Like I don't run across very many articles in the New Yorker or Slate or, so, or, you know, wherever else you want to go, the Atlantic or the Economist, that is like, you know what, actually Amazon is good for literature and books and reading culture.
Or even maybe it's not the worst.
Or maybe it's not the worst. Those types of things tend to come out of the self-publishing community. Mm-hmm. And then, frankly, a lot of the people that read Book Riot on a day in, day out basis who are big Amazon fans and like it for the reasons a lot of people like Amazon, it's convenient, it's fast, and it's inexpensive. You know, they're like, it's good for me, you know, in that kind of way, which, you know, has its strengths and weaknesses as a argument. But you don't see a lot of real discussion amongst the sort of lefty, thinky, kind of book nerd online mm-hmm. people happening at all. So that's a panel I'd go to if I could somehow magically guarantee myself that people would be like, I'm not sure what I think, but let's talk. I don't feel like that's going to be, you know, a slag
just a
fest.
Bunch of right statements about how it's bad and everyone's yeah. upset. We do have a contributor, maybe a couple of Book Riot contributors who are going to attend. So we'll hear about
it. So glad.
We do. And maybe there'll be audio from it afterwards. The New York Public Library records a lot of their mm-hmm. events. So I think at best it could be a really interesting discussion from people who have been in the industry for a long time and who know some things yeah. About at least what their real concerns are. And it would be great if they could acknowledge the benefits as well, at least to readers, if not to big publishing,
yeah,
of working with Amazon.
I think it's
going
to be the choir
but,
preaching to the choir.
But it's, yeah, this is maybe community building by complaining.
Which, hey, you and I, in our own way, have done at our own time. There's nothing wrong with
that.
Sure,
we have.
Speaking of the New York Public Library, I like this story, boy.
Yeah, this is a good one.
The New York Public Library got a grant to begin loaning out Wi-Fi as one of the services that they can offer their patrons. So you can check out for a year a Wi-Fi hotspot that comes preloaded with a year worth of Wi-Fi and use it and then return it.
So great.
So cool. They're starting out with a batch of 10,000.
Yeah, they got $500,000 grant.
Yeah, sounds like a lot, right? Well, 8 million people live in New York, so we're going to be fighting over these. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be targeted at low-income New Yorkers who don't usually have access to broadband. So if you can make a case, I guess, you might start. I don't know how the application process is going to happen. I'll put the link to the show notes if this is something you yourself could make use of or someone you know. I think this is really, really cool. I know the public library branches in New York that I go to at all, there are a lot of people there to use the internet. And it's one of the things that I think is important for a library to do today, just personally. But I also like this idea of reimagining the library as a place where you loan out resources for information gathering mm-hmm. and consumption, and not just, you know, recognizing that books are not the end-all be-all of information, but an important part, but a, you know, there's a complicated array. They're reimagining what they can do with the resources they get from individual grants and in the state and donations and what they can do with that. It reminds me, I saw a story this week too. I'll try to find a link for the show notes about a college. I think it's the University of South Florida that's going to let some of their students check out drones from the library to use for whatever, you know, if they're doing a photography project or some sort of landscape design or any number of projects. You can imagine all sorts of ways that you could use aerial photography of different angles that previously, you know, you need a helicopter or a plane for. But for a $500 drone, you know, you could spend an afternoon shooting the tops of whatever you wanted to see or go to places you couldn't get a camera. So those are two really cool ideas of reimagining what a library can
that's
do.
It's so great. We've talked several times about programs that libraries have taken on to teach their patrons more about how the internet works or how you can use online resources. And I love this step of not just you have to come into the library and use the library's internet on a limited number of computers, which I believe some libraries even have to limit the amount of time that a patron can spend mm-hmm. on the
they
computer
do.
Because
yeah.
there's so much demand for it. But that there's real value in having internet at home. And if you're listening to this show, you are likely a person who already gets to benefit from having the internet at home.
Yeah.
And not being limited in the amount of time or the way that you can access information online, being able to Google anything you want, anytime you want to, is amazing. And applying for jobs and all sorts of things. This is really cool. It's awesome to see the New York Public Library leading the way here. I wonder if anybody else is doing this.
Yeah, so a $500,000 grant for $10,000 hotspot. So it's $50 per hotspot. Mm-hmm. For the year. So they must be getting a deal from service providers too of some kind.
Yeah.
They're being subsidized in that way as well, which is so good job service providers. We like to hear that. All right. Should
Very
we do
cool.
our next sponsor?
Yeah, our next sponsor. We have Random House Audiobooks is back and we're happy to have them. We're both big audiobook fans. And so we know that if you need motivation for your workout, if you're working on a craft project that's like taking forever, and you're sitting there thinking, why am I knitting when I could be holding a book in my hands? Or just if you have a family road trip coming up this summer, you want to spice up your daily commute or your dog walk. I listen to audiobooks on the way to the gym and while walking my dog. I know you listen to them while you're running around New York City and while you're taking your kids back and mm-hmm. forth to daycare and running errands. You can basically, any time that you're not sitting reading a book, you could probably incorporate an audiobook.
You know what? When in our old apartment that we lived in for 12 years, we didn't have a dishwasher.
Oh.
And actually, audiobooks made me sort of look forward to doing the dishes. Not all the way, but like if I was in the middle of a good audiobook, I didn't, you know, oh, okay, I can do the dishes and listen to the audiobook. Like, I kind of liked it.
Yeah.
Not terrible.
I am a terrible housekeeper, but if I put on an audiobook to take the dog out for a walk and I come back in and I'm in the middle of an interesting part or I'm not yet at the end of a chapter or something, I migrate toward the dishes and then the dishes get done more frequently so that I can just
Maybe
in service.
Maybe we should tell Random House Audiobooks that they should have a section. Well, because they have sections. Like if you're going to do knitting or you're traveling,
right.
They should have a section for make terrible tasks not as terrible. That you can, like, what books is good for that?
Right. If you are new to audiobooks, but you're thinking this sounds like something that you want to do while you're traveling or working out or crafting or whatever, you go to tryaudiobooks.com. You can plug in what you're looking for, the length of time that you're looking for, and it will pop out some suggestions for you. You can also look at popular audiobooks. I don't know why I keep wanting to talk about ebooks for fitness or for crafting or for travel or about tech and science fiction or for gardening. There's all sorts of great recommendations, and Random House, being as big as Random House is, you are bound to find something. So you can use their tools and the recommendation engines at tryaudiobooks.com, and then you can purchase the audiobook from the retailer of your choice, either a digital edition or the CDs to listen to, whatever your preference is. But they have great stuff. One of my recent favorite audiobooks is from Random House, and it was I Don't Know What You Know Me From by Judy Greer, who's a very recognizable character actress. She plays supporting roles in many things, but she would be one of those actresses that you probably see her and you're like, oh, it's
her. I know her. Oh,
right.
It's her.
Right. She's that, you were in that thing. She was Kitty on Arrested Development, which is where I know her from. But she's been in a bunch of movies and on a bunch of TV series as well. And it's her memoir about how she grew up and got into acting, what it's like to be an actress who's successful but not a superstar. And it's just funny. She's funny and witty. It was fun to drive around listening to her for several hours and hearing her stories. Really enjoyable, good stuff. So if you're looking.
I can't shut up about Creativity Incorporated by Ed Catmull, which is also published by Random House. I listened to an audio. And I picked it next week. We're on Book Riot, where the editors and contributors are putting together our big list of the best books we've read in 2014 so far. And Creativity Incorporated by Ed Catmull is my pick. He is the chief technical officer of Pixar and Disney Animation Studios, and one of the three basic heads of Pixar, with John Lasseter and Steve Jobs, who made it into the company it was, and were all part of the team when it was sold to Disney for $7.4 billion in 2006. He talks a lot about management and how to run a company that values creativity, and also you get the backstory and some inside dope on Pixar and Disney and The Incredibles and Toy Story, and how originally Woody and Toy Story was going to be a much, 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 much bigger of a jerk than he turned out to be. Yeah, they showed the reels to the people, Lasseter, and they looked at it and they're like, he is a jerk. No one's going to watch this. So they went back and redid the story and defanged him to some degree. So that's Creativity Incorporated by Ed. I was just thinking as we were talking about, you know, what else could you do while listening to audiobooks? I was watching the NBA draft last night, which was slow, but not as slow as, say, a baseball game. So if you're someone that likes to watch baseball on television and you don't care too much for the announcers, you could easily listen to an audiobook while watching sports, right?
Yeah, Bob, my husband, loves the Patrick O'Brien Master and Commander books. And he has this dream that we have not done yet, but of like being at the beach for 2 weeks and just sitting in a nice room watching the waves crash, or like sitting out on a balcony looking at the ocean listening to seafaring stories. I mean you can do all kinds of things.
You could play video games. Video games, if you don't care about the sound, you can listen to an audiobook while playing video games.
In the occasion that an audiobook is really compelling, I have plugged it into or popped it over onto the what is the word for?
I don't know what you're going to say. I'm on the edge of my seat here. It could be anything.
We have a speaker that connects to my phone through Wi-Fi. It's blue something.
Bluetooth.
Yes. Friday afternoon. Loss of vocabulary. I put my audiobook into the Bluetooth speaker and carried the speaker into the bathroom while I showered. And listened.
Really?
Yeah, I've listened to some nerdy business books that way.
In the shower, audiobooks in the shower.
Well, like, this That's is interesting. Good. And it's kind of great. Like, you know, you listen to music in the shower sometimes, or I do. Like, why not?
Are you in the shower for hours on end? I mean, that seems like a lot of work for 15 minutes of audiobook.
Well, it was more like, I need to take a shower now, and I want to keep listening to this. So I'm it's going
here
with me.
I mock, but no judgment.
Bob did, the first time that he was home when that happened, he stuck his head in the bathroom and just yelled, "Nerd!" Oh, yeah.
You know, since it is summertime too, mowing the lawn.
Oh yeah, you could.
Put your headphones on and do some yard work out there.
I know lots of people who listen to audiobooks while they cook.
Cooked, that's something I would consider as listening to an audiobook while
I've
cooking.
I've thought about it. I need to, because I cook a lot, and you can't like easily stand over the stove and stir a
pork shoulder's not going to braise itself.
Right. It takes two hands to flip the pork shoulder once an hour inside the Dutch oven. But if I were listening to an audiobook, I wouldn't have to stop what I was doing. At any rate, all of this sounds interesting to you, you can go to tryaudiobooks.com.
We just want you to try audiobooks. If you haven't, just try that.
Just give it a shot.
Just try it.
With this deal at tryaudiobooks.com, you can listen to your favorite author, find a new bestseller, give any part of your routine a fresh perspective, and add some bookishness to it. And tryaudiobooks.com also has free downloads available, so you can give it a shot without it costing you anything. So thank you to Random House Audio for sponsoring it, for letting us go down this weird rabbit hole.
I think that's a sign of a good sponsor, when you can go down a rabbit hole related
I think so
to
too.
It. Let's get to new books. But before we kind of segue, a new book, it's so new that it's not out yet, and so new that it won't be out until next summer. Judy Blume, Big JB herself, it was announced this week, is publishing her first new adult novel.
Since 1998.
We really need a different term for adult novel, because that sounds like something else. her novel for adults, I don't know. In 2015.
They're trying to get it. It's not for kids or young adults.
It's not a YA book.
Yeah.
It's not a middle grade book. That's all we know about it, right?
Yeah, there's like no details about this yet. It's coming out from Knopf, which is one of the kind of serious literary arms of Random House.
I didn't think about that as a Knopf book. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's her first book not for kids or young adults in 17 years. I am so excited about this.
All the Judy Blume fans are super excited. I like Judy Blume, but I wouldn't say I'm a Judy Blume fan, if that makes sense. But everyone who I know is like, oh, there's a new Judy Blume coming.
Yeah, Judy Blume's editor, Carol Barron, gave a quote to the New York Times when this was announced, and all she said was, it's about family and friendships, love and betrayal, and it's quintessential Judy. So sign me up for this. Like, If I could click a button now that would drop ship me every new book that Judy Blume ever writes, I would do it.
That's really funny. Though I have to admit, that's kind of like the vanilla ice cream of like adult novel book descriptions, right?
Family and friends. It's about everything.
Love and life.
I thought you were going to say that it's the vanilla ice of something, and I was real excited.
Well, you know, stop, collaborate, and listen. Blume is back with a brand new invention.
Something.
Yeah, okay. We can't do vanilla ice lyrics. I mean, it's the summertime, but
it's happening, Jeff. Just let it wash over you.
Now tell me about books that came out.
Let me tell you about new books this week that are out, that came out this past Tuesday. One of them is called Everything I Never Told You by Celeste Ng. And our colleague, Amanda Nelson, picked it as her best book that she's read so far this year. She had made a pick and then she read Everything I Never Told You. And then she was back in the Google Doc that we're all sharing, changing it up. It's about a Chinese American family set in the 1970s, which has lost one of their children. This happens in the first sentence of the book, so it's not a spoiler. And the couple are sort of trying to regroup and figure out how they're going to move forward after it. But it's also about how the wife in the couple gave up her medical career in order to be a wife and mother. And now that she is not a mother, she's wrestling with that as well. The sort of about, you know, the choices that we make, the pressures that exist on us from family and from work, in our pressures from our personal lives, cultural pressure. Amanda said that she was really impressed also with how Ng handles just presenting across a multicultural family in the United States and the varied issues that came up. She's been talking about it nonstop, and Amanda is not like super effusive.
That's interesting. Yeah,
this means something when she gets really exclamation pointy about books. I'm going to read it next. I've had it on my desk, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I think this is probably not the last that we're going to be hearing about Everything I Never Told You. It just came out. So much wonderful conversation about it online. The other big new book this week that I've been hearing a ton about is called Green Girl by Kate Zambrino, and it's a paperback original from Harper Perennial.
Oh, wait, it's a reissue. This came out. This has been out before. It was in the Tournament of Books. Go ahead.
You're right. Sorry.
Okay. All right.
You're right.
All right. Whew. I'm right so infrequently that I always question it when it feels like I'm going to be.
I totally thought it was new. I've been getting press releases out the wazoo about this.
I will, on your defense, insofar as you are defensible, say there has been a lot of talk about it. She's been doing events at bookstores and the interviews, and it feels like a new book for as much as they're doing about it.
So here it is. Yeah, it was first published. Now I'm reading the synopsis online. It was first published in 2011 by a small press.
Right.
And so it got picked up now.
That was the small press entry in the Tournament of Books that year. And
I
read this, but I've largely forgotten it. But I remember thinking it's really, really interesting.
Okay. Well, so Harper Perennial.
Tell me the synopsis. Do you have it in front of you?
Putting it out. Yeah. The heroine Ruth is a young American in London. She spends her days spritzing perfume at a department store that she calls Horrid's, which I would assume is a play on Harrods. And by night, she is desperately trying to navigate a world colored by the unwanted gaze of others and the uncertainty of her own self-regard. So she joins the canon of young people existing in that important, frightening, and exhilarating period of drift and anxiety between youth and adulthood. And the story is told through the eyes of this young narrator.
Hmm.
That also sounds like pretty vague, general coming-of-age copy, like jacket copy, but I'm intrigued.
The thing I remember about it, and again, I didn't take extensive notes and it's been a few years, so all the disclaimers in the world. The thing I remember being about it is that she's a young, good-looking woman, and a lot of it is about being the object of the universe's gaze to some degree, and what it feels like to be an it girl, but not having an it, if that makes
interesting.
Any kind
That's
of
really
sense.
Interesting.
And so it's definitely an experimental kind of novel, but I thought it was really, I'm not surprised after having read it that the tournament guys over there at the Morning News included it. I'm also not surprised that it lost in the first round, but that's not necessarily a comment on its quality, just that it's different.
Books that are super.
Yeah, I think I'll be interested to hear what you say about it, especially in how wrong my memory of it is.
It's bubbling up just in random places. I think I asked on Twitter yesterday, like, booksellers, what are you hand selling lately? And at least one of them mentioned Green Girl. And then this morning I was chatting with an author friend who we were just, you know, talking about what we were reading. And she also said that that's what she's reading right now and totally digging it, which this is my favorite way to come across books to read, is just seeing a bunch of other people that I love and whose opinions I respect say it all kind of all at the same time and be like, well, there's the bandwagon I'm going to jump on. That sounds interesting.
And I know this will just, this will further ring your already ringing bells, but she was did an event with Jenny Offal the other night who wrote the book called The Department of Emergencies or something. What's the name of it?
Department of Speculation.
Okay. That's pretty close.
The Department of Emergencies.
Department of Emergencies. Actually, that sounds, I would read that book. The Department of Emergencies. It sounds like a Jesse Ball novel.
It sounds like a TLC reality series.
Department
I think
emergencies.
This exists already.
Probably it does. So that's Green Girl by Kate Zambrino.
Kate Zambrino. And then out in paperback, actually out just in paperback this week, I'm not lying this time, is The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert. You know her from Eat, Pray, Love and the second memoir, Committed. She's written fiction before, but this was really when people started paying attention to her writing fiction. It's a multi-generational family story that's set in the 18th and 19th century, which is really all that I know about it. Amanda also really loved this and really loved it despite her expectations for it.
It's funny. We're talking about Amanda. Like, she doesn't want to like or recommend a book. She wants to like a book, but she like kind of doesn't want to go out on a limb and recommend things for some reason. I don't know what that is.
Hi, Amanda.
Maybe it's just she doesn't want other people to not like it or something.
I think given her experience with Eat, Pray, Love, and I'll say for myself, given my experience with Eat, Pray, Love, like I have not read The Signature of All Things. I was just prepared when it came out to not read it because I didn't care for Eat, Pray, Love and have not been a fan of Elizabeth Gilbert's work. But Amanda at least took the step of like, well, I'm prepared to not like it, but I'm going to read it. Anyway, and it turned out, I think that it was one of her picks for
it was. I remember that distinctly.
For the best books of 2013. We give each contributor gets two, and this was one of hers.
You know what? That's it. I'm only reading books that Amanda can't help but recommend from now on. That's all I'm reading.
This would be an interesting, like, books you like despite your best intentions not to.
That's a good list. I like that.
That would be an interesting list. And anyway, those are the new books that are out this week. Thank you again to Squarespace and to Random House Audiobooks for sponsoring. You can go to squarespace.com and use the code poetry at checkout to get your first month for free. And you can visit tryaudiobooks.com to get a free audiobook from Random House and check out new things. And that's our show.
That is our show. As always, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Reading Ape. She is at Rebecca Shinsky, S-C-H-I-N-S-K-Y. You can find us writing all the time at bookriot@bookriot.com. Speaking of Amanda,
she's going to be back next week.
She's going to be back on the show next week. And I would like to take the moment to say she is taking over the daily editor duties of Book Riot next week. Mm-hmm. So we're super excited about that. So thank you to Amanda and congratulations and good work and all of that stuff that's going on next week. Rebecca and I are still doing stuff, just different kind of stuff. Let's see. If you want to leave us a review on iTunes, it's the summertime. You know what? You could listen to an audiobook while leaving us a review on iTunes. That's something you could do. It'd be a short audiobook or a really long review. Either way, your choice. That helps people find the show, gets us more listeners. More listeners gets us more sponsors. More sponsors means we get to keep these diamond-encrusted podcast mics that we are paying monthly installments on, you know. And that's, you know, we got to live with a little swag. What can I say? If you want to find show notes for the show, go to bookriot.com/podcast. You can find the links to all the stories we talked about and the books we talked about for this show and all the other shows. If you've got feedback for us, if you're wondering how much, why I hate Amazon so much, that's the place to ask it. I will respond to you in a very cogent and not at all angry way. That's podcast@bookriot.com. I'm getting cynical here at the end. What happened?
I got
a little sarcastic.
I'm back at Diamond Encrusted Podcast Mike.
That's a callback to, I think, our first show. I made a joke about that. I'm surprised you don't have everything I've ever said on the tip of your
tongue. I am just weighed down by my Flava Flav clock necklace.
We should get podcast mic clock necklaces.
Yes.
That would definitely be something I would not wear.
Think Geek probably already makes them.
with like a Doctor Who joke emblazoned on it.
We're cooked, man. This is it.
This is it. We're done. You know,
have a good week.
We gotta get back. I will talk to you guys someplace. Have a good week, everybody.
Bye.